Are we recording? No, too much. Hey everybody, welcome to Ducks Watch Together. I'm Josh.
I'm Kylie.
And on today's episode, we compare and contrast Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man. Spoiler alert, one of them is not amazing.
One of them's garbage.
Yeah, one of them's like real, real garbage.
Okay. So, Josh, why are we doing this?
Because
I know I have an answer for that. I have a personal answer to that.
Okay.
But I want to know what your take on it all is, and then we'll compare our answers.
Because Kylie had a really hard time making a list for that paired with Spider-Man, and this is the only thing we can figure out to do?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So, my answer is, because our first list was good reboots or something like that.
Yeah.
We didn't really fullize it. We just had the word reboot.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's like, well, this is Michael Keaton moments. And then neither of us were really motivated. And so then it was just like, well, let's just do what we did with 13 Reasons Why and watch something else and compare them.
We only do the best for you, listeners.
So we were just going to do Spider-Man. And then I was like, do you want me to see if I can get The Amazing Spider-Man at the library? And we can also compare that. And you went, ugh, that means I have to watch The Amazing Spider-Man. And then I said, we don't have to. And you said, fine, let's get it.
And then we sat through it.
Here we are.
You know, afterwards, I was like, oh, we could have just done coming-of-age films. That's pretty much what Spider-Man Homecoming is.
No.
All right, we're here for top five coming of age films. Number one, here we go.
Boyhood.
Boyhood 2.
This is not a movie.
Yet. Wait 12 years.
Oh my gosh.
Yes! Secretly Richard
Manhood.
It would be called Young Adulthood, thank you very much. God, don't jump to the third one yet.
And then the fourth one, the
middle-agedhood.
Middle-aged, and then we have elderly.
Hood. They'll have to end in hood.
All right. So, Spider-Man.
All right. So in this episode, we're going to talk about Spider-Man 2002, Sam Raimi, and The Amazing Spider-Man, some year, Mark Webb.
2012.
Sure.
10.
Sure.
I'm going to go with 10.
Great.
Because other than Amazing Spider-Man 2 is 2014, and so I'm going to give them 4 years to make a movie.
They probably only did it in 2.
It might be 2012. Oh, gosh.
Now we got to look things
place
up.
Place your bets, Josh.
Ooh, I'm going to say 10. 12.
You're going to go with 12? Okay, yeah. Good, because I'm going to go with 10.
2012. Woo!
They did it in 2 years, and it
explains
shows.
Explains so much! All right, before we do that, let's jump into our question of the week. And it's actually a really, really simple question of the week.
Spider-Man.
What?
My answer is Spider-Man.
Your answer is Spider-Man?
Okay.
Great. Which Spider-Man is
Tobey
your
Maguire.
Favorite? Toby, Tom Holland, or Andrew Garfield? Not only which, but why?
So I picked Tobey Maguire because I see much more of an emotional arc from him. And so while I think that Tom Holland is a very fun character, I think that Tobey Maguire gives an emotional arc. His Peter Parker has, I understand his drive a lot more, and I understand his emotional connection to the people around him. While with Tom Holland, I don't quite see that. Not fault of Tom Holland, but more of a fault of the script that he was placed in. And so I do think that Tobey Maguire's has a different Spider-Man, but I think that it's a better one, and it's one that's easier to connect with.
Ditto.
Word for word, exactly.
Word for word. Yeah, I also am on the Tobey Maguire bandwagon. I think that's because he, in terms of, like, much like that Batman conversation or Doctor Who conversation, like, who is your Batman? Who is your Doctor Who? Tobey Maguire is my Spider-Man.
Michael Keaton,
right there. I think that there's a level of emotional connection to that character that he brings, as well as, You know, you can really see in the DNA of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man that he appreciated and liked the Tim Burton Batman, and you can see that there's a clear, there's some similarities between them, and so I think that Tobey Maguire and Michael Keaton give similar-ish performances in each of their films that allow us to connect and relate to them, like you said, where there's a big emotional arc and over the course of his films, and I appreciate them, even though Spider-Man 3 is a hot pile of trash.
I haven't seen it, so I only have the first two.
And he's not great as Peter Parker in that one. I still think it works. Tom Holland is close, but I just don't quite have that time to live with that character yet. But some of y'all might feel that way. And listen, if you do, you should tell us why at friendofafriendpodcast.squarespace.com or on Facebook at friendofafriendpodcast or on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, where you can find this show and leave us a 5-star review and subscribe to our podcast. That's something you should do, as well as answer the question of the week, which is your favorite Spider-Man? Also, if you want to defend Andrew Garfield, bring it on.
I'm going to hijack the question of the week real quick, because I think this is also an important and interesting question.
All right.
What is the best Spider-Man love interest? So we have Liz, MJ, and Gwen Stacy.
Gwen Stacy twice! Can't forget Bryce Dallas Howard is Gwen Stacy.
It's pretty easy to forget. I haven't seen the third one. Oh. This is, I think.
It's a really interesting question. Because I think there's two different answers. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, but I don't know. Okay. So, as we will talk about later, and maybe this will just be kind of how we start this conversation, Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy is hands down the best part of The Amazing Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and that whole franchise. However, Mary Jane and Kirsten Dunst, I think she, in all the things that are not faithful about the first kind of films, I think that's actually a very faithful version of Mary Jane. I think that it's clear that she's kind of that, like, just fun loving party girl who just wants to be an actress. And yes, in Spider-Man 3, she does some real jerky things, but we're not going to pay attention to those right now.
You're right, because we're only focused on the first films in all the franchises.
Fair. Are we just going to pretend that Spider-Man's 2 and Amazing Spider-Man 2 don't exist?
And 3.
Great. This is a good question.
Mm-hmm. So I think that Gwen Stacy is a more fully realized character.
Yes.
Than Mary Jane.
Agreed.
But the connection between Mary Jane and Peter Parker feels stronger.
And that's essentially the sentence that I was going to get to.
Mm-hmm. Because I phrase this as love interest. So if I phrase it solely as love interest, Mary Jane.
But if you ask me who's the stronger character, it's probably Gwen Stacy. I mean, which is interesting enough, because if you look at their purposes in the comics, so Mary Jane is talked about well before she's ever introduced with that really iconic comic panel. Like, one of the most iconic comic panels of all time is where Peter opens the door and you just see Mary Jane as this knockout girl who just says, you've hit the jackpot, Tiger. Like, and that is one of the most iconic frames in all of Spider-Man history. And that frame is a device that is used over and over again with their relationship in terms of how it is there. Gwen Stacy is only introduced as an obstacle in between those two to keep them apart. And so her sole purpose in Spider-Man's comic life is to be a wedge in between him and Mary Jane, and to die. That those are her purposes.
Which, I mean, the death of Gwen Stacy is one of the most famous comic books.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
Marvel, a couple of summers ago, had their 75th anniversary, and they ranked their most important, like, their most famous and most important storylines. Uh-huh. Number one's Gwen Stacy's death.
Yeah.
Like, it does so much to that character, because that's, like, where he, like, that's where he faces, like, oh my gosh, I'm Spider-Man, I couldn't save someone.
And then the other thing that it does, too, which is really important, is that Mary Jane, in that moment, so he's just sad and broken and alone, and Peter Parker is essentially a jerk and says, get out, go away, and she doesn't. She closes the door and stays in and says, no, I'm going to be here with you for this. And so that's why I say that her sole purpose is to further that Mary Jane relationship, mm-hmm. even though that moment itself furthers Peter as well. Because you have to further Peter to get him to a point to be with Mary Jane.
Yeah, and Gwen Stacy's death is so that he can overcome the Green
Goblin. Yes. So while it is a iconic moment, and
it's the woman in the refrigerator.
Yes.
Deal.
Yeah, yeah. And while it is an iconic moment, it is in service of another thing. I think what's really interesting is that with like Batman, you see he's really iconic for his rogues and his villains and those things like that. And Spider-Man, who is probably the other, like those two, Batman, Spider-Man, are the figureheads of their respective companies. He has good villains, but he is known for his love stories. Mm-hmm. Like, the most famous characters in his universe besides him are probably Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy. And, like, in a different way, Aunt May, you know. And so it's his relationships with others that are what's important to him. And I think that's really interesting to see those two compare and contrast against each other. Man, this is the eternal comic debate. Gwen Stacy or Mary Jane?
Good thing we're a movie podcast.
Yeah, so if I had to pick one, I would say Mary Jane, only because their connection is really beautiful. And yes, there's some really fun, good chemistry between Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker as Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone, but I feel that's really one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew Garfield is... There's great chemistry between Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone, not necessarily between Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker, and if that makes sense.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I mean, Mary Jane spends a lot of time in those movies needing to be rescued, while Gwen yes. Stacy is the one is making choices, and
yeah.
she is the one who's more in charge of her destiny.
And really, it's Mary Jane's arc that... So, I know Spider-Man 2 doesn't exist in our comparison.
We can open it
but,
up.
If you look at the end of Spider-Man 2, to where, so, it's revealed to Mary Jane at the end of that film.
We're not going to spoil these
oh, yeah.
Spider-Man 1 through 3.
And Spider-Man 1, 2, 3, Amazing Spider-Man 1, 2. We will try to not spoil Spider-Man Homecoming,
We
I
might
guess.
Talk about elements of it, but as a whole, if you... Our conversation about Homecoming, which we do make some comparisons to the other films already,
yeah.
Is in our last episode. But we might talk about a few elements, but we won't spoil the
yeah.
whole movie.
But we will be spoiling all the Sam Raimi ones and all the Mark Webb ones. So, at the end of Spider-Man 2, it is revealed to Mary Jane that Spider-Man is Peter Parker, and he tells her... we can't be together because I can't put you in this danger. But then she runs out on her wedding and goes to him and says, I get to make that choice.
Well, I mean, Gwen Stacy does the same thing of she finds out that he's Spider-Man, but she continues to be part of
right.
that.
Right. It just takes, it's an extra film for Mary Jane mm-hmm. to take that step and do that with. So just in that sense of, Gwen Stacy starts out as a stronger character than Mary Jane does, but I think that allows for some arc that, I mean, I've only seen Spider-Man 2 once, but I don't think that she's got a whole lot going on.
Sorry, Amazing Spider-Man 2?
Yeah.
No. Well, it's because they've broken up, and so then he's just trying to get over her / win her back. In fact, what he's mostly doing is stalking her in that film. Kind of weird.
Yeah.
Not good times.
But so, I mean, I think that in terms of that, then there's not a whole lot going on for the Gwen Stacy character mm-hmm. in that.
Well, if you want to answer our question, Kylie's question of the week.
Right.
You can do so at all the places we mentioned before.
All right, let's jump into a little bit more of these films. I think we had a good discussion between the two love interests of the film, and now we can kind of dive into them
a little
bit
more. We didn't even talk about Liz. She's there.
She's there. She exists.
I'm glad that she wasn't even... We didn't even bring her up. I think I said Liz, Gwen Stacy, MJ.
I think that's the problem with Liz, though. She just kind of is there, and she's clearly a placeholder for Zendaya for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Good on ya. You exist.
Okay. Why doesn't Andrew Garfield work as Spider-Man? Should I leave that question till the end?
No, it's a good place to start. I mean, I think it's really clear what we like Spider-Man 1, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, and we don't like the Amazing Spider-Man. So why doesn't Andrew Garfield work? It's a great question.
I don't ever buy him as...
a teenager? Yep, nope, not at all.
I barely buy Emma Stone as a teenager either.
And she's closer.
They're like, we're gonna give her some stockings. That's what the kids wear, right? Put her hair in a ponytail. That'll make her look younger.
All right, let's see. So Amazing Spider-Man comes out in...
2012.
And Andrew Garfield is born in 1983.
So we'll say it was made in 2011. 11
minus 1983. It's 28. And good old Toby.
I think Toby's like...
I think Toby is 28 as well, too. Yeah. 1975, so 2001 minus 1975.
26.
26! 2 years younger!
He did it.
Those very two important years. I mean, listen, that's not totally fair. I don't buy Toby Maguire as a high schooler either.
But it's okay, because he's only a high schooler for
half the film. And I mean, I guess what is helpful to that is that Kirsten Dunst is 19 mm-hmm. when the film is being made. So she is a high schooler. And I guess when you play them off of each other a lot more, like, you kind of see him working a little bit. I mean, this argument might also work for Emma Stone because she was born in 1988. What year did we say that that film was made? 2011 mm-hmm. minus 1988? I know. We're a film podcast, not a math podcast. 23. So she's still older.
And Tom Holland's about 20.
21. Or 20.
He yeah. just turned 21. Okay, so when 20. The film's being made, he's yeah. 19 to 20.
James Franco. Important thing here.
Don't worry, I'll look up Rosemary Harris. Rosemary
Harris. Her official age is just grandma. 23. So yeah, I think that Franco and Dunst help lower the age of Maguire. Mm-hmm. And I can't really say that that works in the other film. So no, he doesn't work as an actual teenager. Even if they would have just put the Amazing Spider-Man, if they knew they wanted to cast Andrew Garfield, who became famous because of The Social Network, where I played a college student.
Just have him play a college student.
Just have him play a college student.
Like, Spider-Man is literally a high schooler, so I'll talk about The Amazing Spider-Man, because mm-hmm. there's too many other storylines. But in The Amazing Spider-Man, only about probably a third of that comic takes place in high school, and there's other things when he's in college and when he's an adult that you could have gone with. So constricting Spider-Man solely to high school is not necessary. He can be an adult.
Which is why I think the Spider-Man works better. It's because it starts dealing with those problems after high school, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the film, the moment Ben Parker dies, like, two scenes later, he graduates from high school, and it's all about him becoming who he is as a man outside of being in high school. And if Amazing Spider-Man would take place in college, like, spoiler alert, everybody, when you're a senior in high school and a freshman in college, you're not that much more emotionally changed!
If anything, you're worse. Because you're back at the bottom and you're scared and you don't know anything that's happening and you have to be an adult.
So, you know, maybe it could have worked. So why doesn't Andrew Garfield work as Spider-Man? I don't think he really ever cared. I think it was a job to him. And whether or not that Tobey Maguire cared, I can't say. But Tobey Maguire at least seemed to put in some work and some effort to make. I mean, Tobey Maguire gets a bad rap just for being Tobey Maguire because he's just kind of... I don't know if he's a great actor.
I think he also gets it because, like, I mean, if you compare aesthetically to Andrew Garfield is much more attractive than Tobey Maguire, and I think that that's part of it. I mean, when The Amazing Spider-Man came out, like, all the high schoolers, girls were like, "Ooh, attractive 30-year-old! Whoa!" While, I mean, Tobey Maguire is...
he's a nerd.
He's a regular-looking person.
Yeah. And he looks and feels like a nerd. Like, that's the thing that I think that works with that one, is that Tobey Maguire feels like he is... Peter Parker's a nerd. Like, that's what he is. He's a science nerd and through and through.
And I never believe that Andrew Garfield Spider-Man can go and make these web shooters. I never buy that. I never buy that.
I buy Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy as the scientist more than I buy Andrew Garfield.
And so, like, that also ends up hurting it, because it's like, I don't believe that you would come up with this. And I think that that's another helpful thing with Sam Raimi's, is that we don't have to worry about the technology of it. He has web shooting powers, and yeah. I think that that helps him out.
Well, in Homecoming, he has web shooters, but I also
buy Tom Holland a little bit more.
Yeah,
being able to make those.
Yeah,
and I mean, it helps that Tony Stark also.
But those web shooters are his, because there's a couple scenes where we see that he has homemade
his own. Yeah.
Yeah. I like how I'm just doing the motion. Like, you guys can all see the motion, right? This is how it works. Like, this is. Spider-Man, where he's like, huh, and he's like flicking it, and just have a rock symbol, go web, go
fly. And it's like scenes like that make me believe that this guy is a loser, that he's a nerd, that he's not popular. I look at Andrew Garfield and I see the way that he feels with his environment, and he feels like a cool guy. He's a real cool person,
right? And even it's because in And part of that is like, I get what you're trying to do with Flash Thompson, but also, like, halfway through the film, Flash kind of becomes his friend.
He hugs him.
And you're like, now are you cool? Like, I don't know what you are anymore. You're very inconsistent. It seems like Tobey Maguire, Peter Parker, is uncool, not by choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that Andrew Garfield, Peter Parker, is cool by choice.
Yeah.
You know, or uncool by choice, sorry.
Maybe it's just like, ugh, orphan. We don't like orphans. Because that's the only reason why I can think these people don't like Andrew Garfield.
They're like, oh man, he's been a senior like 4 years.
And then by giving Flash Thompson to get on his side, then it shows that Peter Parker has power. And like,
yeah.
Peter Parker should.
Okay, let's move on from that to directors. I like both Mark Webb and Sam Raimi, and in fact, interestingly enough,
I like them both when they don't, like, I like the Spider-Man movies, but I also really like when Sam Raimi isn't given a huge budget. Like, see,
For me, I was actually going to be like, I like Mark Webb when he's not doing Spider-Man films, and I kind of only like Sam Raimi when he's doing Spider-Man films.
No, but you don't like horror.
Exactly!
Well, I don't like when he's given Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oh, that's
he's
not
given,
good either.
He's yeah. given, like, any check that he wants.
And Evil Dead 2 is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, that absolutely
and
is.
That's where he gets a slight bigger... I mean, Evil Dead, he has, like, a gift card to Target.
That's impressive. For just having a gift card to Target, Evil Dead's impressive.
All I will say about Evil Dead, while I don't like the movie, the fact that it got made is astonishing to me.
Right.
Like, when Bruce Campbell tells you about, like, everything that's going wrong, it's incredible that, like, it's somehow stitched together.
Something actually got put on film. Enough to get a sequel, even.
Which he then remakes the movie, but funnier.
Sam Raimi clearly has passion for this project and clearly wants to tell an interesting Spider-Man story, but you can also see his flares, his elements of horror, his elements of camp, with Bruce Campbell being there. I think especially with the wrestling scene in the first film, you see a ton of those elements in there. And so, whereas with Mark Webb, he has done much smaller films. The only one that he did before this was 500 Days of Summer, and he's since done Gifted 2 films later. But with 500 Days of Summer, you don't see any of that, his pacing, his flair, his style, his really kind of thing that he sets up in there as what makes him a unique kind of director. None of that is in The Amazing Spider-Man. So to see these two directors take these visions of Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man, one of them has a vision, and it's clear that he's using his toolbox. He's using his tools and his talents in a big studio realm. And the other one is just, I made a movie. I'm a competent director, but I'm not. And it's because I don't want to say that he's not a talented director, because I've loved his 2 films that are not the Amazing Spider-Man franchise. Mm-hmm. You know? So...
Well, and I think that Sam Raimi is comfortable creating a comic book world.
Yes.
Or, like, at least a very heightened world from our own world. While, I mean... Mark Webb goes for the gritty real. I'm looking at the two posters. And the Spider-Man 2002, we got this, like, nice orange, you know,
The Spielberg orange.
The Spielberg orange. And then we have the Amazing Spider-Man, which is dark and blue. And it's, like, the it's in that vein of, like, Zack Snyder, gritty, Watch Menace.
It's not quite that bad, but yes, it is. Well, interestingly enough, I was talking to Anne yesterday on the way home, and... one of the things she really appreciated about Spider-Man Homecoming was the portrayal of New York, mm-hmm. and how it was very specifically, it was Queens, it was small, it felt like it was this part of New York that we hadn't really seen before. But even though, yes, we've seen Queens on screen a lot, but this felt like a unique version of New York. And then she made the comparison that 2002 Spider-Man makes, it also is a very unique New York. It's the more kind of midtown, like downtown kind of New York, but it has its own heightened feel to it. And this, the Andrew Garfield one, the Amazing Spider-Man, is a very bland version of New York. It's any big city world, you know. And even in, like, Spider-Man 2, where we get a whole Times Square sequence, it just feels really sterile and not all that interesting. And so, in terms of world building, the original Spider-Man is on par to me with, like, the Gotham City that's built. I think that what Sam Raimi does really, really, really well is he builds up this New York that is Spider-Man's New York. It's heightened. There are things that happen in it. It's very... There is camp elements of it, and I think the camp elements work, mm-hmm. you know?
I think that that helps separate it from a lot of other comic book movies that we're seeing, because there are the comic book movies that are going into the dark, gritty, and then they're the ones that are going into the reality. Well, this one feels comfortable being a comic book movie, and I think that Sam Raimi's camp is what makes it like that.
Well, and I want to take a moment to kind of, like, let's back out a little bit here and take... Because I think when you look at superhero films on a whole, mm-hmm. as to... There are some of them that are very successful being dark and gritty. And there are some of them that are being very successful being bright and campy. And I think what you have to take into context is where we are, and I'll speak specifically to America because the world is a different, its own thing, but where we are specifically in our world and what we want in our superheroes. If we look towards Batman and we look at the times where Batman is good and the Batman is successful, we've got 89 and 91, and then we've got the Dark Knight franchise from like 05, it's 08?
08 is when the Dark Knight is, which is when it's most successful.
So it's like 2005, 2008, and then I think it's 2009 or whatever. I don't know whenever those other ones come out. But yes, 2008-ish era. But if you look at both those eras, America itself is in a pretty good position. We're not really in any sort of life or death war that Americans super care about. Our economies are generally pretty okay. Lifestyle in general is pretty fine. So what do we want as an escapism? We want a darker, grittier world. We're like, yeah, I like this dark, gritty. It's different than what I'm in every day. And then if we look at now, and we look at sort of like the Justice Leagues, and when this Amazing Spider-Man comes out and stuff like that, we're in the middle of a recession, and now we're in the middle of a very political turmoil time where there's all this upheaval, and the world in our world is very dark. It's very dense. So what is not working as escapism? Dark, grim, gritty things. Mm-hmm. What is working successfully as escapism is brighter, happier. And I think that what you see is when we're successful with this is when we're understanding what form of escapism that we as a society want to go to. And Spider-Man in 2002 understands that we want bright, happy escapism at that point. That is right after 9/11.
And it also wants to show New York being a community and a strong community. Because there's the scene where they're like, if you mess with Spider-Man, you mess with all New York. You mess with us. Like,
you mess
we're
with
strong.
One, you mess with all.
And
which,
so, like, that's a very, like, we gotta pull New York together. We gotta show that there's strength among
right.
us.
Right, and in the final, like, thing where Green Goblin has, where Green Goblin has the cart, not a cart. Whatever that thing is. Trolley, thank you. Full of kids and teachers, and then it's got Mary Jane, and you gotta let him go. In that moment, we see that Spider-Man needs help, and New York comes together to help him. And meaning community, we need to help each other. Whereas when we get to The Amazing Spider-Man, we're in such an economic, like, lull and trying to get out of things that it's just, we don't want to be in a sad, dark world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's a little bit about the directors. Villains, I think that most superhero films are successful because of their villain relationship. Let's talk about the villains.
Willem Dafoe is terrifying. He's great. He has to do so much because you have to have sad Norman Osborn, but then you have to have crazy Willem Dafoe, and he camps the heck out of it. And I feel like Sam Raimi was just like, be like Bruce Campbell. Just kind of, just go there. And Willem Dafoe was like, okay, I can do that. And then he just went crazy.
Right?
Can you go back to when you were in Shadow of a Vampire?
I love that he would want to be in Shadow of a Vampire, Willem Dafoe. That's great. I love it. That's probably why he cast him, though.
Huh. Shadow of a Vampire. This could be my Greek
this, goblin. This could be it.
What happens if we put a green tint on him?
Oh, you mean what happens if he has a disease that makes him sick and turns him into...
We're not talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2. You know, what are we going to do when we get to judging Harry's? Because there's no Harry. Spider-Man has no friends in The Amazing Spider-Man.
We'll get there. Let's stay on the villains.
I'm sorry, I'm just really angsty.
You and, Peter Parker, always. Okay, so, yes, Willem Dafoe, I think, is a wonderful villain, and his... I think what's great about him is that he does have that duality of character, and that we see that Norman Osborn genuinely cares for Peter Parker at the start of the film, and we get to see this arc and this building sort of tension between the two, because at first there's a respect, and there is a mutual respect for the two characters throughout the whole film, and so when we finally... when Norman figures out that it's Peter, then like that intensifies, and this relationship, which we see is one way we can look at and see in a different sort of light. Spider-Man itself is all about Peter Parker becoming a man, and that is the arc of the film. He's growing up to become whatever man he's going to be, and with great power comes great responsibility, and that line is used as the thesis of the film. And every motivation, including Willem Dafoe's, is about challenging this great power that he has, including to the point where at the end, which is again the trolley and Mary Jane, that choice is about your responsibility as an adult. Your responsibility as a grown-up adult. You have to choose.
Save both.
Somehow. I mean, theoretically, if you want to look at that in that argument... So, man, I can't remember what it's called, but there's some sort of, like, scientific theory where it's like, there's a railroad, and you've got 5 people tied to the train tracks on one side, and you've got 1 person tied to the train tracks on the other side, and it's going to kill the 5 people if you don't do anything, but you can pull the lever and have it only kill the 1. And it's like, what do you do in that situation? And so that's just a dramatization of that moment.
It's literally referred to as the trolley problem.
The trolley problem? Mm-hmm. Great. And so it's like, what do you do? And then it's intensified. It's like, what do you do if you know and love the 1 person versus the 5 you don't know or whatever? And technically, though he's successful, so the theory of this is you will not be successful in 1 of them. You make a choice, somebody dies. What choice do you make?
So you either have to make the choice of not doing anything or doing something.
Yeah.
And like...
And this is the present. This is the choice that's put in front of Peter Parker, and yes, he has to make a choice, and yes, he ends up breaking this because he saves everybody.
Just yell at the people to get off the track.
But technically, Peter Parker makes a choice. He chooses to save Mary Jane first, which is a very human choice, which is something that I like. And if he would have failed, it would have been a giant mistake. And however, he doesn't actually save everybody by himself. he only saves Mary Jane. It is with the help of the people on the bridge.
The New Yorkers.
And the people driving the barge that he's actually able to save the people in the trolley. And therefore Mary Jane.
That's what was missing in Homecoming. There were no New Yorkers saying, we still have Spider-Man.
There was one guy. He was on the.
Yeah, Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly.
There is even a New Yorkers coming together to help Andrew Garfield.
There is
the cranes, the crane operators. So the working class comes together to help Spider-Man.
So, with that being said, Spider-Man's villain in the Green Goblin and Willem Dafoe all serves a similar thematic purpose. We understand what this film is about. I can tell you nothing about what The Amazing Spider-Man is about. And its villain of Dr. Connors.
He doesn't have an arm.
But he doesn't have an arm.
He wants his arm back. Great. Like, that's his motivations, I think, right? He just wants his arm back.
He wants his arm, but in getting his arm, he creates a monster.
Yeah, he becomes insane, so he becomes...
All they want to see is Shady.
He becomes a green villain who goes insane, who reverts back and forth between sanity and insanity. Have you heard that before? Yeah, it's called Willem Dafoe.
Doc Ock.
Most spider villains. But... Why? What's the purpose of all that? What's the greater purpose in terms of Peter Parker?
What?
What's the greater purpose in terms of Peter Parker?
In that story?
Yeah.
Well, there probably isn't one.
There's not!
We need someone for Peter Parker to fight.
It's really bad. Like, the character design is atrocious. And that being said, there is some flaws with the Green Goblin's costume. I mean, you can't really see Willem Dafoe's face. It's just you're kind of staring at plastic for a long time when he's in that costume. But, you know, I guess it's better than staring at awful CGI.
When we see Willem Dafoe, it's great. It's like the shark. You don't see it all the time.
Right. I mean, there is a legit criticism of the first Spider-Man film where you could just, if you watched it without sound, especially in the ending sequences, it's just a mask versus a plastic mask. And you're just like, Like, there's nothing there. It's like, all right. And that's why, that is legit the reason why in almost all subsequent superhero films, in climactic moments, the hero doesn't have their mask on, or their mask is not covering their whole face, is because of Spider-Man 1, where they're like, this is just two masks just yelling at each other. Like,
I really need some climactic elements in here. Let's rip his mask a little bit so we just have the one eye. And then, like... Let's bloody up his lip a little bit.
So yeah, I mean, you get this stupid villain of the Lizard in this film that's not set up well. Somehow it's connected to Peter's parents, which is a stupid arc anyway. I don't care about Peter's parents. I care about them in terms of that they died. That's it. That's all I need for them to be.
I care about Ben and Aunt May. Or I should, but I kind of don't in this movie either.
Yeah. I don't even really remember. Like, outside... We just watched The Amazing Spider-Man. I cannot tell you what that climactic fight sequence is. I can tell you about the cranes, because it's hilarious.
It's when Dennis Leary dies.
Yeah, but I don't...
because...
Where are they fighting?
Well, Josh, it's really hard to say, because our DVD kept skipping, because it was from the library.
Well, we got it, okay? We saw the end of the film.
Yeah, you...
I did! And it worked! And it worked, by the way!
I was so shocked. You gotta get toothpaste for that, you know?
Nope, just gotta blow on it. Hit it a little bit and put it back in.
So, my understanding of his motives were he wanted to make other people lizards.
Oh, yeah! Why?
Because he was crazy.
Oh, great, of course. There's no connection between Parker and Connors outside of the fact that they met each other a couple times. I mean, the Dr. Connors character is in all of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, and if the fourth one had come to fruition, he would have been the villain, and that would have been a nice setup.
I thought Vulture would.
It was going to be a dual villain thing again.
That doesn't work.
I know, it didn't work.
We need one villain.
I know. I hate that, like, when they get to... They're like, oh, it's got a two. It's got to have two villains in it. Ah, three. Got to have three villains in it.
Does Spider-Man 2 have two villains?
No, that's why it works.
We focus on the
one. I mean, it has a sub-villain. Technically, Harry Osborn is a villain in that film, but yeah. He's not...
He's more of an antagonist.
Yes, absolutely.
Because, I mean, it's yeah. James Franco. What's he really going to do?
Yeah. But, I mean, like, The Dark Knight has two... Dark Knight Rises has three.
Yeah, and only one of those works.
Right? Spider-Man 3 has three.
Who's the third villain?
In Dark Knight Rises?
Catwoman?
It's Catwoman, Bane...
Yeah, she's barely a villain.
And Talia al Ghul.
Yeah, she's barely a villain.
She's still a villain.
She's Anne Hathaway. No. I can't take that as a... You know when it kind of works? When it does work, Batman Returns, because we got Catwoman, we got the Penguin, got that other guy.
Max Shriek?
Yeah.
It's only two, though. That's the two.
Penguin. I Catwoman.
I know.
Max.
No, it's done.
It's three.
I know.
That's three.
But in my theory, it's only the second film, so.
Well, Catwoman kind of is just mischief.
Oh, so it's just But yes, no, you are right. It
Max,
works in there.
Max murders a woman.
It only works when... really does. It only works when the villains are working together. When they're trying to do... Like,
yeah, like when Poison Ivy
shut
and
up, shut up,
the
shut
Iceman are working
shut up,
together.
Shut up, it's Mr. Freeze. Shut up. We're not talking about Batman and Robin 20th anniversary.
Two-Face.
Shut up. No, get over it.
And the Riddler work together. Or when it's Batman and Lex Luthor or Superman. I don't know who the villain of that movie was.
Are you done? You done?
There are two villains in Batman Begins. Ra's al Ghul and Scarecrow.
That's true. Gotta have all of it there.
Got a lot of enemies.
I got enemies. Got
a
lot
of
enemies.
And we're just naming Batman films at
I know,
this
like,
point.
Why are you, like, what are you doing?
I'm just breaking your theory.
Great. It never works.
Except for in Spider-Man 1 and 2.
All I was saying is that if they have a purpose to work together, that is the reason why you have multiple. If they do not mm-hmm. have a purpose to work together, then just have one.
Well, and I think in a lot of the things that we've been talking about, they're not villains the entire way through. It's like, yeah. You have the main villain, and then
yeah.
the twist happens, and then you got another villain.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, moving past villains, let's talk Aunt May and Uncle Ben.
Oh, okay. Well, they're great in Spider-Man, and Martin Sheen's kind of okay, and then Sally Fields I don't think has a character.
Nope.
I'm just really waiting for that Aunt May solo film where she's in nursing school.
Why do you insist on bringing that up?
Because I think it's one of the stupidest things.
She's not in nursing school. She's like an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. or some nonsense.
What?
Yeah. Like, no, it's... It was supposed to be like she's like some super sexy agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. spy.
Is this before or after?
Before.
Oh, man. I really want...
It's a prequel.
I kind of want Sally Fields to do this, though. Why? Why are we making Aunt May anything than just a motherly figure to Peter Parker?
Like, gotta have sexy Aunt May.
I mean... Just go watch Hello, My Name is
that
Doris.
That seems like a dangerous Google. Sexy Aunt May.
Should I go for it?
Oh gosh, here we go.
Nothing's popping up.
Images?
I think I got Melissa Tomei.
Lots of Marissa Tomei. There's a Deadpool character in there for some reason.
Oh yeah, look at that sex appeal. It's
pretty much just Marissa Tomei at this point.
And like Aunt May getting shot.
Well, if you want to have that fun in your lives too.
Google all right. Sexy Aunt May. See what we're talking about.
Ben Parker and May. Aunt May. Oh,
they're great in Spider-Man. I believe that they love their nephew, and I believe that they care for him, and I believe that he also cares for them.
I like one of my favorite scenes in all of the film.
In all of film.
In all of Spider-Man is where Uncle Ben's at the table. He's like, hey, Michelangelo, we're going to paint the kitchen later. I love that scene. It's like, don't do it without me.
Don't start with me.
And, it's so good. Like, it's just sweet and it's simple. And you understand their relationship. And then you understand why when he gets all angsty because of his spider powers later that Ben's worried about him. And they have that talk in the car. And with great power comes great responsibility. And it's said so perfectly. You never need to say it again.
That's why I didn't try to do
it.
Okay,
maybe you should try to say it again. But like, geez, if you're gonna remake it, just don't like half-ass it.
With responsibility comes great power, Peter.
As I hate the fact that he doesn't get to say the line in Amazing Spider-Man, because like, if you're gonna retell the Ben Parker story, you have to tell that moment. You can't sidestep that moment and rephrase the most famous line in all of Spider-Man mythology.
Peter, are you Spider-Man? Because I think that if you have such a I think you need to have a lot of responsibility.
I think that was honestly one of the problems with The Amazing Spider-Man is they try to be so not Spider-Man because it was too soon to remake the property, so they try to go
Maybe you shouldn't have remade it then. It didn't work.
Bing, 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 bing. Kylie wins. But I think that that's part of the problem is you've tried to do it too fast, so then you're trying to be so not that original film, and that original film works. It's just frustrating.
I can't fix it, Josh.
It's just... Kylie, why can't you fix it? Kylie, I need you to fix it, Kylie. Kylie, I need you to fix this problem. Why are you just sitting there?
I
need you to go back and work it.
Go back in time and, like, tweet at Mark Webb just, like, every second of filming Mark.
Okay, hang on. You have time travel powers and all you're gonna do is go back to tweet?
No, all I can do is, I can do the Wolverine time travel where it's in my own mind. Uh-huh. And so I go back to my body where I still don't have any power because I'm a 10th grader and no one listens to me.
Everyone's like, I'm gonna tweet every day, all day.
Mark. I'm from the future.
Mark Webb, I'm from the future.
I'll private message him every day until he blocks me. And then I'll start tweeting at Andrew.
Andrew Garfield, I'm from the future. And they'll be like, have you met this girl? She says she has a future. She says her movie's terrible.
You're thinking Paul Giamatti for the Rhino in the sequel. I'll just tell him how everything in the what.
You're thinking Jamie Foxx.
I know that you're thinking about having more Simon Garfunkel named movies.
Maybe you should just go back further and be like, hey, Mark Webb, I know you just finished 500 Days of Summer.
No, I'm gonna go back further and go to Sam Raimi and be like, hey, no emo dancing.
He didn't want to make 3 anyway. Like, that's the problem with 3. He didn't want to make that film. He wanted to make a different version of that film, and then he got really beat up in the process, and so he was like, whatever, I'll just make whatever stupid script this is. And then he was gonna try to rebound in 4, and then they didn't like the direction he was going in 4.
He did well with the first two. What happens if you just kind of let him do something?
They forced Venom in there. Why? He didn't want to do Venom. He wanted to finish the Harry Osborn story.
I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
Then they had Sandman. Ugh, everyone.
Topher Grace.
Topher Grace wasn't Sandman.
No, he was Venom. I'm still upset about it.
Eddie Brock.
All right. What's wrong with Aunt May and Uncle Ben in The Amazing Spider-Man?
Because I don't think that Andrew Garfield cares about that.
Not at all.
He's like, I'm Andrew Garfield, I'm pretty dang cool.
And Martin Sheen tries. Like, he's a good cast for Uncle Ben. I mean, I think the thing is like, with The Amazing Spider-Man...
What? I'm thinking of a quote of a comment you made during the movie because me and Ann were like, yeah, they took all the great qualities of Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen and put them into one person.
And then what did I say?
That's how fatherhood works.
That is how fatherhood works. I think it's really interesting that the two lesser known actors of Rosemary Harris and whoever plays Uncle Ben, I don't know that guy's name, but I know he gives a great performance, versus Sally Field and Martin Sheen. It's just because you put name actors in there doesn't mean they're right for the part. I think they cast better actors for the part. Martin Sheen is good as Uncle Ben. He's just written really poorly, and Martin Sheen can't even save that. You know, I think that it's just
to be fair. I think everyone's written really poorly in that.
Let's talk dialogue, Kylie. I know you love the dialogue of The Amazing Spider-Man.
Cliff Robertson. He passed away in 2011. Okay. The dialogue.
Yeah.
The dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, see, so, you know how, I don't know if, so, when you're in a language film, or in a language class, okay, and you're trying to do some translating stuff, and you put it into Google Translate.
Great.
And then it comes out, and it's other words, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
So here's what I think happened. I think that they had a script that might have sounded like actual humans talking.
Okay.
And then they're like, well, let's see what it looks like in Spanish. And they put it into Google Translate, and they're like, ugh. And then they went from Spanish back to English. And then whatever that presented, they're like, this is good. Let's just, they rewrote it for us. It's perfect. This sounds like what humans talk about. And then Emma Stone gets in, and she's like, I break up with you.
And Emma Stone just rewrites it so it works better, but nobody else does.
The dialogue in The Amazing Spider-Man is atrocious. It's like they don't know what people talk like. Not just teenagers, you know? It's everyone. No one knows what a human sounds like in that film.
It's real true.
Sam Raimi's Spider-Man feels much more natural, and it feels like they have interacted with people once before in their lives.
Yeah.
David Koepp? 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 I think does a very good job of creating realistic dialogue within this hyper-reality.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I mean, there's more to break down. Is there any last things that you want to talk about here? I feel like we're really just ramrodding.
Yeah, let's talk Spider-Man. About the best friends.
Okay, go
so
for
I
it.
So I think James Franco's really good as Harry Osborn. It's my favorite Franco role, which he does much better in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Or in Spider-Man 2. And then, in The Amazing Spider-Man, Peter doesn't have any friends, so, you know.
He's kind of got Emma Stone.
Yeah, that's MJ. Her counterpart is MJ.
He's got...
You're right, Josh. Later on, he gets Dane DeHaan, but we're not talking about those, remember?
Oh, God!
Hey, Peter.
Okay.
I'm Dane DeHaan. I'm going to talk very mysterious in a low voice so that you know I'm sick and moody.
There you go.
All right.
Great. I'm real done. Spider-Man's good. Amazing Spider-Man is trash. The Amazing Spider-Man is not the worst of the Amazing Spider-Man franchise, though. So, nor is it as bad as Spider-Man 3. So, I guess there's that for it. But in comparing these films, there's no need to... Yes, Spider-Man Homecoming is an origin story, so it's nice that we looked at all three origin stories, but it's very different than both of these, which I appreciate. And so, yeah, I would definitely, if I'm ranking the origin stories, to me, it goes Spider-Man, Spider-Man Homecoming, The Amazing Spider-Man.
Can you tell you the directors who were considered for this role?
For
directing Spider-Man?
Sure.
Okay. Roland Emmerich. Ang Lee.
Okay.
This is pre-Hulk, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not saying it would have been good, but I mean, okay.
He's a director.
Yeah. That's probably why he got Hulk. Hulk comes out in 2003.
He's got conferences. Chris Columbus.
Ugh.
Jean Dubont.
Jean Dubont. Ugh.
Here you go.
Sam Raimi. Oh, good job.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan ma ding dong.
Tony Scott.
Okay.
And David Fincher.
Fincher. Interesting. All right. Good thing Sam Raimi got it. Otherwise, Fincher. It would have been two.
It would be a very different
film. It would have not... See, and that's because I think the studio, like... That's clearly had to be Raimi had passion and showed that he had passion for the project. Because all of those are the ones that are like, we're just going to make a live-action, destruction-y film. Now, and see, Raimi is... credited in so many ways for helping bring the superhero genre forward with this film, because he is a filmmaker who understands what the genre is and needs to be, and he helps define the genre. And as X-Men with Bryan Singer and this with Sam Raimi, help usher the beginning of this superhero revolution into film and modern culture. So I think that that's another reason why Spider-Man 1 will always be an iconic piece of that thing. Because yes, we've got the Batman series, but by the end of it, it had fallen so far, and the Superman series was so far in the rearview mirror, and both of those were exceptions in an era that it's really X-Men and Spider-Man that push it up into the stratosphere.
Until Nolan, really.
Until, well, I mean,
there are some more comic book movies made in between, but I just remember them failing a lot of times. I mean, like Daredevil.
But Electra, yeah, so essentially we get this nice little push here, because X2 and Spider-Man 2 mm-hmm. are also good, and then we have that lull of a lot of bad Marvel films.
The third ones,
and then the Daredevils and the Electras and the Catwomans and like all of that stuff there, because they're not understanding what's making those films great. And then you get 2008, which is Iron Man
and
Batman Begins.
I think that Batman Begins is 2005.
Okay, so 5 and 8 is kind of that. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's kind of growing, but you need to stand on the shoulders of these two mm-hmm. to get there.
Yeah.
So, right on. All right. Hey, if you want to join this conversation, you can do so at friendandfriendpodcast.squarespace.com. You can also do so on our Facebook page at Friend and Friend Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at
DWT_podcast.
You can find us on YouTube at
Ducks Watch Together.
Tumblr's at
Ducks Watch Together.
Letterboxd at
Darby ACT and Kylie Gallagher.
And finally, and most importantly, you can find us on Apple Podcasts and iTunes, where you can subscribe and leave us a 5-star review and find all of our episodes to this podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Josh.
I'm Kylie.
Quack, 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 quack.